Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a discussion of progressive issues of faith and action, coming to you in the 75th anniversary year of WESU, 88.1 FM Middletown, and at WESUFM.org, and repeated on UConn's WHUS 91.7 FM stores and WHUS.org, UConn's Radio for the People. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, the Reasonably Catholic Keeping the Faith Year in Review. I'll keep this opening short so as to fit in as many clips as possible, but as we start 2015, I do want to thank you all for listening and also give a big, grateful shout-out to the guests who've so generously given their time to come on the show and share their wisdom. Listening to them all as I put this episode together was a reminder that people are truly good and that, yes, progress may be slow, but it is being made. Thank you all for helping me in my spiritual journey. And I invite you to visit the blog reasonablycatholic.com for the complete audio of all the shows excerpted on this program, among other very cool content, including a photo of some beach glass I picked up during a stroll on Christmas morning. It doesn't sound like much, but check it out. Back in a moment with our trip down memory lane.
Hi, I'm Nick Ingala, spokesperson for Voice of the Faithful, a worldwide movement of faithful Roman Catholics who work to support survivors of clergy sexual abuse, to support priests of integrity, and to increase the laity's role in governing and guiding our church. As an organization working to effect change in the Catholic Church by raising our voices, we value the opportunity to get the word out, and we can't rely on Vatican Radio or the Catholic News Agency to run our point of view. Fortunately, Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, which is heard right here on WESU-FM, does not shy away from points of view that, for example, take the Catholic hierarchy to task. So we're grateful to WESU-FM for airing the type of programming that makes people think hard about Catholic issues. Please support this station by giving whatever you can. Just go to WESUFM.org and click on Donate Now. Thanks.
We kicked off the year by interviewing U.S. Congressman John B. Larson, a Connecticut Democrat, who introduced a resolution congratulating Pope Francis on his election to the Holy See. He shared the episode with Sarah Abbott of Resource Generation, telling us how we all can be philanthropic, even on limited incomes. Next, in our episode on holiness, we heard from Father Pat McCloskey, author of a book on the saints, and then from Barbara Pivarnik, a Connecticut laywoman who really puts her faith into practice. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, the Year in Review show. Because I am a sinner, I can't resist asking you one more thing.
Sure.
Have you ever been tempted to shut down any lanes of the Charter Oak Bridge to punish a political opponent?
Well, I haven't had that opportunity to shut down any lanes, but listen, I think the people in New Jersey will get to the bottom of this.
I need you to confess, you are enjoying it. It is just the yummiest story ever.
Well, I think that, this seems to be one of the most venal and petty things that I've seen in a long time in politics.
So you have a job with a nonprofit, and you live in New York City, which
yes,
we all know is not cheap.
No.
And you're not getting support from your parents, and
right,
yet you're giving money away routinely.
Yeah.
To the causes you believe in. So are you managing?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I keep saying this term, like, class privilege, which, you know, means coming from families who are, you know, anywhere from upper middle class to very, very wealthy. And I think that having class privilege actually sets me up to work a nonprofit job and live in New York City and, you know, live on a reasonable budget and be able to save money and have, you know, have some money to give away. You know, I think that comes from, like, having gone to a great school. And I think, you know, I keep mentioning debt, but I think it's such a huge deal to not be in debt, especially as a recent college grad. And it comes from, you know, being taught how to be in a job interview and how to use, you know, language that sounds, you know, quote unquote smart, and having had braces and having straight teeth and, like, all of these things that support me to be able to make it,
right.
You know,
to say
and
nothing
a lot of, and having white skin, you know,
I
a
was
lot
just
of things
say.
A lot of people don't have.
Yeah.
And those are all things that are, you know, marks against people or are keeping people back from being able to make it.
Sometimes people have talked about saints as though they were policemen who could be persuaded to fix a parking ticket. I'll kind of go behind the scenes and pull some strings. And that's not the case. They always point us to God, but they point us to God in their variety. In the early days of Christianity, the premier saint, of course, was Mary, but then Joseph and John the Evangelist and then the other apostles were regarded as martyrs. Then Christianity became a legal religion, and we had desert fathers and mothers. And then we have founders of religious communities, such as Francis of Assisi and Dominic and Benedict and Scholastica. But the shoemaker can be a saint. The carpenter can be a saint. You know, the mother raising five children can be a saint. Holiness is possible for any person at any time in any place.
I learned at an early age to differentiate between spirituality and religion. And probably the foundation and center of my life has not changed from when I was a little girl till the present moment. And that is, my life is about prayer, going to daily Eucharist, and also devotion to the Blessed Mother. And I think about, when I go to Mass every day, why and what draws me, and it draws me like a magnet, to the celebration of the Mass. And I think that I have been invited, and I have the unique opportunity, as all Catholics in the world, to attend a banquet that we're invited to celebrate the Scripture, crucifixion, the Passion, and the resurrection of God every day. And we're nourished at that table. How could I say no?
So, I can't resist stating for the record that you are married, and I'm imagining Fran, her husband, wondering whether he was going to lose you to the convent.
Yeah, actually, he's very happy because he gets to eat breakfast without me talking to him and coming up with ideas every morning. So he thinks it's great when I leave the house at 7:45. So
you know, I'm putting together your meditation practice, and what you're saying is your kind of talkative nature, and I'm deciding that you are just a fully integrated person.
Well, you know, I really, with all the energy and commitment to outside missions, the meditation and the contemplative prayer sustains me. Without it, nothing's possible. Just sitting and surrendering with no words, closing my eyes, even with a million distractions, amazing things happen because we're not doing anything but paying attention and sitting in light and love. And what could be better than that?
This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU 88.1 FM Middletown, now in its 75th year of providing community radio that matters, and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS 91.7 FM Stores, UConn's radio for the people. Up next, former seminarian Jacques Lamar, now a playwright, who describes life in the Vatican during his formative period on several fronts as he explored becoming a priest. Following Jacques is Commonweal film critic Richard Oliva with his take on the Oscar-winning films last year, as well as on the Bible epic Son of God. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith. the Year in Review show. Thanks for listening. Back in a moment.
My name is Father John Baptist Pesch from Holy Family Monastery in West Hartford. I think this is a great contribution to what the church is supposed to be at all times, but especially in our day when we're emphasizing more and more the church as the people of God. It's a wonderful program, and I'm glad that Maria Johnson, she took the challenge up when she recognized that there were certain voices that were not giving the proper impression of the way Catholics should respond to the realities of life in the political and social order. I'm in favor of this, even though maybe sometimes I hear things that I don't really approve of. So what? I mean, nobody has a monopoly on what the church is. I encourage you to really to support this by your prayers. We always say that and we mean it. But I also mean this. Any kind of a sacrifice you can make to give to the program is well worth it. And I really hope that if I disturbed your conscience a little bit, I hope you'll make the most of it. Thanks a lot.
Here you are in a seminary about to, I mean, your mission is to become a celibate priest.
Yes.
And you're having these feelings, and it's all so new. I mean, this must have been a kind of seismic thing going on inside you.
Yeah, and not just me. I mean, I would say,
right.
You know, it happened with a lot of the guys. I mean, some of them had been in minor seminary. Some of them had been out of the closet, had lived open lives as gay men. Some were straight. You know, but it was just a very weird crucible to be thrown into. And again, you don't have your family there. You don't have your friends there. You're in a foreign country. And so...
Was it painful? I mean, you must have been conflicted.
Well, it was wonderfully liberating in some ways to be able to finally talk to other gay men about it and know they were in the exact same boat as you. And there's that wonderful torment of your first crush who doesn't reciprocate their feelings towards you. You know, it's where I had my first sexual experience, and that was great and then terrible. And, you know, it was just so...
Was the terrible part... I'm sorry to obsess about this, but was the terrible part related to guilt and feeling like, what am I doing? This is totally not in line with what I'm supposed to be about?
Less so. Uh-huh. You know, actually, I wasn't necessarily ripped apart. I mean, I knew that if I got caught, I would be kicked out.
Okay. So it was more about the repercussions that were freaking you out.
Well, no, it's just the first person I fooled around with turned out to be a psycho. But and so but I mean, there was that, you know, I know what I'm here for. I know what I'm doing is wrong. I know that I, you know, this is maybe not the best place to work these things out. And after a year and a half of having very strong feelings for this one guy that did not reciprocate them.
The psycho?
No.
Oh.
No. He reciprocated.
Oh, yeah.
And then also the, you know, I should say, I mean, it's not fair to call him a psycho, but he was probably not in his right mind at the time.
Okay.
A very sweet guy, but, you know, he was working his stuff out too. And so we were just not in the right place to be able to. And that's the thing is, you know, you may fall in love with someone, but there's no way of expressing it that's normal. And, you know, there was definite concern, particularly about my class being very campy with each other. You know, there was definitely a very gay vibe about my class. And, you know, we would refer to each other as she's and hers and whatnot. Like, oh, did you see her at lunch or whatever? And,
oh, my God.
And this, you know, certain things would rise to the surface in such a way that the faculty would be made aware of it. And so, you know, there were talking to's that would happen, not necessarily to me in particular, but to the class in general.
Like, buddy, you need to rein yourself in.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
I mean, there was one classmate of mine who I adored. His room became the room where everyone would congregate and have coffee and cake and whatever. And it became like a coffee clutch. It was a bunch of, like, you know, old hens. It was like a hen house. And a Monsignor came to the room and said, you know, is so-and-so here? And he's like, oh, you must be so-and-so. And he said, no, it's his, oh, I'm trying to remember the name. It was like, it's his evil sister, Loretta or something. And so then, like, his room became known as Loretta's. And it was like, you're going to Loretta's for coffee. I wish I could remember. Oh, Maxine. It was Maxine. It was his evil twin, Maxine. And so, you know, we got yelled at for calling it Maxine's and all this other stuff.
The funny thing about Philomena is, as I describe it, it sounds like a tragedy or a soap opera or a exposé. It's not any of those things. It's a comedy of the clash between opposite spirits. Martin Sixsmith is so dour and so sophisticated and so jaded and so blasé, and yet at the same time so capable of bitterness, that he has this kind of Laurel and Hardy relationship with Philomena, who's she's kind of loosey-goosey and sometimes inane and silly, and yet she also has this deep wisdom. I compared them in my review to Laurel and Hardy, because if you remember Laurel and Hardy, Stanton Laurel is this kind of silly,
innocent.
saintly innocent, this innocent idiot who's also kind of saintly. And Oliver Hardy is the guy for whom the glass is always half empty. And is always complaining, a fine mess you've got us in now. And this is the kind of relationship between Philomena and Sixsmith. She keeps saying these idiotic things and spinning out the plots of these Harlequin romances she's been reading. And he's this sophisticated literary guy who's bored to tears by it, but can't help being drawn by her super innocence. And by the end of the movie, when she summons up forgiveness for the nuns, the old nuns who gave away her child, and he just can't believe it. He wants her to share his bitterness, and she refuses to do so. She says, I don't want to be like you. And she doesn't mean it as a big put-down, because actually she likes him and gets along with him. But she doesn't want his bitterness. And she's the true Christian by the end of the movie. And that's why I thought it was the most Christian film of the year, and was Christian film for several years.
This new Son of God movie is out right now, and I get the feeling we want to warn people away from it before it's too late.
I wonder how many people who need to be warned away from it will be listening to this program. Aren't you a little bit too unevangelistic?
Interesting. So you think the movie is that?
Well, you expressed a question before we began the broadcast about why do we need this movie? But apparently hundreds of thousands and millions of people are going to it. So there is a need.
So it's speaking to some evangelical.
I want to say it's in your face, but that that doesn't really express the simple-mindedness and the vulgarity of it. And the
it's like headlines from the gospel.
Yeah, headlines from the gospels. Yeah, I'm reviewing it for Commonweal magazine, and I noted that it not only takes the highlights of the gospel, which is understandable. I mean, why wouldn't you want the highlights of the gospels? But it cuts into the scenes just to give you the most famous moments. It's like illustrations of the Bible with captions underneath.
Hello, this is Denise J. Stankovic, editor of Today's American Catholic. As editor of a liberal, independent publication not affiliated with the institutional church, I recognize the importance of radio stations like WESU that provide an outlet for alternative opinions. For example, Reasonably Catholic, whose guests express views that may differ from what you hear in church. Please make a donation. You can do that at WESUFM.org. Thank you.
We hear next from Voice of the Faithful President Mark Mullaney on Pope Francis's lost opportunity, and then a clip from our April Fool's Day show featuring the Catholic Catechism. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith. Thanks for listening.
There is still abuse going on. You may be familiar with the Pope's comment. He had a long interview on many subjects with the Italian press, and one of the questions in the middle was about the sexual abuse, the clergy sexual abuse, and where he thought it was going, and or what he thought the current status of that was. And he basically said the Catholic Church has done more than anybody else in terms of sexual abuse, and it's really a family issue much more than a church issue. And I feel that he missed an opportunity there to basically say, I don't disagree with him. It is a family issue, and that is probably, I don't know if it's larger. Yeah, it is larger than what's gone on within the church, but he's in charge of what's gone on within the church. And he is in a position, although they have done some things to, in fact, improve the landscape, there are still secret files. There's not one bishop that has been reprimanded from the Vatican. They've been moved. Cardinal Law has been moved back from Boston to the Vatican into a plush assignment in one of the basilicas there, and now he's retired. So, I mean, no, there have been no consequences for bishops for the cover-up. So he missed an opportunity, I think, at that point. Not that he will continue to miss it, but he's missed an opportunity to address the that concept and say, you know, mea culpa, we have done badly, and we need to correct it, and we need to make the change, and we need to be the model for the world.
I don't know anything about God.
Who?
God!
Who's God?
God? You do not know who God is? Sister? Sister, we have an atheist here. Let me tell you, little boy. God is, God was, and God always will be. One. What he is?
What is that?
He is the Father, he is the Son, he is the Holy Ghost. He is three in one. Do you understand? I'm 4 years of age, why wouldn't I? Greatest theological question in the world, three people in one, and I'm naturally, yeah. Where is he? He is here. Well, I can't see him. That doesn't mean because you can't see him that he's not here. It doesn't? He's in the cupboard. He's not in the cupboard! God doesn't go into cupboards. He's under the stairs. He's not under the stairs. He's here with us now. He's upstairs. He's downstairs. He's outside. He's inside. He's everywhere. I think he's a big one. Why can't I see him? And ask, do you love him? Do you love him? I don't know. I've never seen him. God loves you.
Thank you.
And he wants your love.
Thank you.
But if you do not give him your love, he will cast you into everlasting flame.
What?
He will cast you into everlasting flame. Have you ever burnt yourself?
Yeah, I burnt myself on the candle.
What was it like?
I'm very sore.
Can you imagine that pain all over your body? That's what will happen to you if you do not love God. What do you think of that?
I love him.
I love him! Then I asked, who was the fellow on the cross? Jesus.
Who's Jesus?
He's the Son of God. I've told you. Father, the Son, and Holy Ghost. He's the Son of God.
Oh.
He was born on Christmas Day and died on Easter. I didn't think he didn't hang around, did he?
What happened to him?
He died because of you. Christ died on the cross because of your sins.
When was this?
It was 2,000 years ago. They can't blame me. I'm only four for sake. I didn't do nothing. Did he have a daddy? Of course he had a daddy. I've told you he had a daddy. God was his daddy.
Did he have a mummy?
Yes, he had a mummy. Mary was his mummy.
So God was married to Mary.
No, God was not married to Mary. Mary was married to Joseph. Shut up!
This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU 88.1 FM Middletown, now in its 75th year of providing community radio that matters, and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS 91.7 FM Storrs, UConn's radio for the people.
Hello, this is Arthur Myers, director of Russell Library in Middletown, and I'm very happy to participate in this effort to bring greater awareness of WESU to the area. During the week, if I can listen, I am especially interested in Reasonably Catholic because of its breadth of participation of various people. I was on it myself. On the weekend, I'm especially listening to some of the alternative music or music that I wouldn't ordinarily listen to, whether it's from different countries or certainly younger recording artists. Otherwise, during the week, if you're able to listen to it, you have such wonderful programs in the morning as the Diane Rehm Show. You have Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. And those kinds of programs that are just plain broadening for anybody. And I urge you to both continue to listen and support WESU. Thank you.
Next up, Father Fred Kammer of Loyola University in New Orleans, who tells us why Tax Day is something of a holy day of obligation. We'll also hear a story about clericalism, courtesy of a Voice of the Faithful conference workshop, and then, perhaps offending pious ears even more than the joke show did, the pioneering feminist theologian Rosemary Radford Ruther shares her less-than-traditional view of the resurrection. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, the Year in Review.
The common good was the responsibility of elected officials in the Greek city-states. And it was also considered to be the responsibility of citizens. So we actually get our word politician from the Greek word polis, which means city. And so the word politics, politician, political, all come from the word for city, and the concept of the common good goes back to the Greek city-states. And the common good had three essential parts. One was the defense of the individual rights of citizens. The second was the proper relationships among groups within any entity, because you can have the common good in a family or a state or a city or an organization or whatever. And the third was security, well, peace, really, that is rooted in security. So if you think about Ukraine right now or Syria, they can't really achieve a state of the common good because of civil war going on or various wars and things going on. But among these duties was a responsibility to pay taxes. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church actually says this: submission to authority and co-responsibility for the common good makes it morally obligatory to pay taxes, to exercise the right to vote, and to defend one's country. So it fits in within the framework of my responsibility as citizen. So when people do their tax returns, it's not so much, oh, the government is taking this money away from me, but they can think about it more in terms of the moral responsibility they have to the well-being of their country or their city or their state or whatever it may be. So we have this old fundamental principle about the common good.
A friend of mine who was a Jesuit who was on the faculty at one time of St. Louis University, which is a Jesuit school, and he's at lunch one day, and one of his fellow Jesuits is talking about having said Mass that morning or on a recent morning, and he sees the line coming up for communion, and he knows that the rule is you don't serve communion to a non-Catholic. You're also not supposed to be unchristian in any way. And he sees about 10th on the line coming up to communion a friend of his whom he knows well and knows to be a Presbyterian. And he's 8th on the line, and he's thinking to himself, and he's got this whole bunch of Jesuits listening to his story, and he's thinking to himself, what do? I'm not supposed to serve communion to a Protestant. And now he's 5th on line saying, but I'm not supposed to do anything unchristian, and then certainly not supposed to embarrass this man in any way. And he's 3rd on line and not supposed to serve communion and he's dragging the story out. And the Jesuits are hanging on this. And finally, the man is before me, and I had to make a decision. I said, what did you do? I thought to myself, what would Jesus do? And the Jesuits all said, oh, no, you didn't.
So, you know, there's this continual process of rereading that tradition to make it make sense. Makes sense both in terms of what it is actually there historically and makes sense for how we relate to it today.
Well, just in the interest of the other shoe dropping, since we're talking about the crucifixion, do you believe he rose from the dead?
I think the early community remembers him, and in remembering him, he continued to live in their memory. He didn't literally, physically rise from the dead, because that actually makes no sense.
So, no, I'm just remembering that I have a priest friend who would say, you know, if we don't believe he rose from the dead, then what's the point of any of this?
If your only faith is based on that kind of literalism, too bad for you.
Okay. Wow. All right.
Now, you know, I'm not sort of way off in the corner. This is the normal, progressive Christian understanding. I've been teaching in Christian seminaries for 40 years.
Without any objection people who sign your paycheck.
Right.
This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU 88.1 FM Middletown and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS 91.7 FM Storrs. Next, we go to New York City to witness two women getting ordained to the Catholic priesthood. And then comes Nun on the Bus extraordinaire Simone Campbell's explanation of why a broken heart ain't all that bad. And that's followed by John Ryan, who cycled across Connecticut again as part of the Break the Cycle of Poverty campaign. And then we'll wrap up this batch of clips with Ophelia, a 104-year-old woman who regularly plays bingo at a Stratford, Connecticut parish hall. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, the Year in Review show. Thanks for listening.
Our loving Mother, Father God, give these women, your servants, the graces of priesthood. Renew within them the spirit of holiness. As co-workers with the community of bishops and priests, may they be faithful in the ministries they receive from you. Together with the people of God, may they flourish in grace-filled, loving community. I invite you all to extend your hands with me. Send your Holy Spirit on them. May the Spirit's sevenfold gifts strengthen them to carry out their ministry faithfully.
Now the good news about having a broken heart, I've discovered, is that when your heart is broken open, there's room for a lot more people. There's no limit to who you can bring into your heart. And so the spiritual question becomes, how open is your heart? How broken open is your heart? And have you been able to release some hope into this darkness? That is the challenge. And Pope Francis, in this amazing exhortation, says, if you want to build peace, one of the four key components is to be based in reality and not in theories. Base what we're doing in the reality of real people's lives, not in some theoretical construct that you can always fight about. The truth will set us free, but it's the truth of people's lives. Therein lies the joy of the gospel.
When you're pedaling up those hills, think about how the poor pedal up hills every day. We get to the top of the hill and we can coast down. Poor have a very, very hard time getting to the top of the hill.
And then once they do, if they do, there's no coasting.
There's more hill. You ride and you come up a hill and you feel pretty good, and then it levels out and takes a turn and it goes up again. And then it turns and, around the trees it goes and it goes up again.
It's like Vermont.
Like Vermont. Like Western Connecticut.
You speak from experience.
Yes. And so the poor have that kind of thing where they don't get that, they don't get the sense of it's flattening out. It's I can coast for a little bit. We're called to be in solidarity with people.
Well, I just enjoy it. I enjoy hearing the laughing and talking. You know what I mean? I don't walk around. I'm not a person that try to find out anybody's how they live or anything like that. But
you mind your own business.
I'm my own business, and I love everyone.
B13. Who's got a big O? You got a red table on the right.
This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU 88.1 FM Middletown and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS 91.7 FM Storrs. Our next clump of clips begins with Camden, New Jersey artist and writer Brother Mickey McGrath on Dorothy Day's founding of the Catholic Worker Movement. And then we celebrate 40 years of Episcopal women priests with the Reverend Molly Loudon on justice. The author of a book about nuns who tended the wounded and dying during the Civil War describes their unique impact. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, the Year in Review show. Thanks for listening.
And she said, "You made me a journalist. Help me find something that you want me to do with this writing talent you've given me." And the very next day, there's a knock at her door, and it's Peter Morin. And he said, "I have a dream of something called the Catholic Worker." And he said, "It's to promote Catholic social teaching." And she said, "What's that?" It's now the height of the Depression, and people, especially men, are walking around aimlessly looking for work to feed their families. There's no food anywhere. And she said, that night in her apartment, the Catholic Worker was born, and they made soup. And 1 week later, 1,500 people were at the door, the line wrapped around the block. And she said, "We need a building to house these people. They're homeless, you know, what can we do?" And that's how the Catholic Worker came about. It was that kind of casual and sudden. And she said, "This is what God's will is. After my prayer, this is what I'm supposed to do as a journalist." And she said, "The way to get the message out is to start a newspaper." So the Catholic Worker newspaper was born, and the first issue was put out on May 1st, 1933, which was Communist May Day. And that's when they had a rally in Union Square in New York. And she said, "We have to show the Catholic equivalent of what the communists are saying over on the other side of the park." So she said, she told the Catholic Workers, the little strikely bunch of people that were coming around her in those early days, she said, "Leave the paper on subway cars and park benches, and that's how we'll get the word out." The first time they made one, it was 1,500 issues. A month later, they needed 25,000 issues. And a year later, they were printing 150,000 copies of the Catholic Worker, charging a penny for it. And to this day, if you get it, it's only a penny. Because she said, "You can't just give it away. It'll mean nothing to people." So a penny was a lot of money during the Depression, you know? But it gave people a sense of dignity and worth that they bought this paper. And she wrote a column, and that was her favorite thing in life. It was called On Pilgrimage. And that's how she identified herself the rest of her life, as a journalist.
Yeah, and one of the things I like about the Daughters of Charity I thought was interesting was the wide cornets that they wore at that time.
For the listeners, they look like the Flying Nun.
Yes, that's how I always describe it to people. And very cumbersome, but they were unique in having that among all the Catholic sisters. But it identified them. I mean, going to Gettysburg, in fact, afterwards, where they had to pass, they were coming north through some of the routes that the Confederates had used to retreat. And the Union Army had set up sharpshooters along the way in case the Confederates changed their mind and came back. And it was said that they'd see that wide cornet and the white, the bright white, and it was like a flag of truce. They realized, I mean, they knew who it was from a distance.
Wow.
And multiple times, wounded soldiers would see the wide white, almost wing-like look to the cornet, and they knew that, you know, someone was coming to help them.
I doubt that their minds were changed. I think, like any justice issue, you have to live with people that you believe should not be included. You have to get to know them. You have to really be touched by their ministry and by their call to change your mind. Mm. It has to be personal. You have to know somebody who's being cut out. If you know somebody who is being told that they don't belong and that they're excluded, the only way, at least, that my mind has ever been changed is to really have a personal relationship with someone whom the culture or the church excludes, and come into an awareness that that's absolutely unjust.
Come fall, feeling a bit academic perhaps, we welcomed Wesleyan President Michael Roth to talk about that famous atheist Sigmund Freud. And then President Roth kindly agreed to come back the following time and talk about his book on the liberal arts. These two clips illustrate how smart and funny he is. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, the Year in Review show. Thanks for listening. Back in a moment.
Anyway, he says to me, I'd like you to talk to the congregation about why you come to Torah study. I said, oh, Rabbi, I can't do that. Why not? You come every week. I said, yeah, but on Yom Kippur, there's 1,000 people there, and you don't want to hear from me. I'm an atheist, I say to him. He listens. Who cares what you are? I said, what do you mean? He says, God doesn't care what you believe in. And I was so struck by this. God doesn't care what you believe in. He goes, yeah, they're Jews. You know, we're not Christians. God doesn't care about faith. You come every week. Talk about what you want to talk about. So I did that. And
that just makes me want to weep.
It's
That's
like,
so
beautiful. I think it's is it Niels Bohr who does this? Your listeners will know. Somebody will know who the scientists come to his cabin and they see he has a mezuzah on the door. And they're shocked. You know, he's a famous physicist. And they said, what, do you believe in this thing? He says, oh, I don't believe in it, but I hear it works anyway. I think curious for sure, but I think that I also was very much afraid that I didn't belong at Wesleyan. I'm the first generation of my family to go to college. I had never heard of Wesleyan. I didn't know anybody went to Wesleyan or any place like Wesleyan when I was in high school. And so I thought I had to prove something. And so at the time, I probably wouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
But I had to prove something to myself, to my family, to the people around me. You know, when I went to Wesleyan, I had never met anyone who had gone to a private school that wasn't a Catholic school.
Wow.
I never even heard of a private school. And so when people talked about prep schools, I didn't know what the heck they were talking about. And so I was surrounded by lots of people who had fancy educations.
Yeah.
And it didn't take me that long to realize they weren't very bright. But but they were well prepared and wealthy. And so I think I had a little chip on my shoulder, I guess, and wanted to really show that I could, do well. And at the same time, as I hope happens to a lot of our students, I fell in love. I had, great friends and had this job in a kitchen, which gave me some of the great relationships of my life with the cooks who worked there and other people we worked with. So it was a well-rounded experience in some respects. But in other respects, I was really focused on on learning through my classes, and it did work actually. I think I slept about 3 hours a night. I think, and I don't recommend that. Don't try that at home.
President Roth, thank you.
Thank you. It's lots of fun to
this
talk with you,
great.
And I hope I may not be reasonably Catholic, but I
not yet.
But don't tell my rabbi.
Thanks. This next clip from a Boston College panel discussion launching the Boston Globe's expanded Catholic coverage, called Crux, features Boston Archbishop Sean O'Malley telling a truly heartbreaking story of an encounter with a desperate immigrant. That's followed by a return visit during election season by Mark Silk, director of Trinity College's Leonard Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion in Public Life. He shared the episode with Sister Elaine Betancourt, Connecticut's own nun on the bus, on being a quote-unquote rock star. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, the Year in Review show. Thanks for listening.
When I was newly ordained and went to the Centro Cattolico, the first week that I was there, this man came into my office from El Salvador. He sat down across from me and broke down and was crying so hard he couldn't talk. He just gave me a letter, and it was from his wife. And in the letter, his wife was castigating him for having abandoned her and her six children, and they were starving. And afterwards, he explained, he said, I came here because the war's going on, we couldn't farm, and I came with a group of men, the coyotes brought me up, the smugglers. I live in one room with half a dozen men from my village. We wash dishes in different restaurants. I eat the scraps off the dirty plates so as not to spend any money on food. And I walk to work so as not to spend the bus fare, so that all the money I earned every week I send back to my wife in 6 months, and she has not received one letter. And so I said, well, how did you send it? With money orders or check? He said, no, always cash. He said, I put it in an envelope, and I put the stamps that people told me I should use, and I put it in that blue mailbox on the corner. And I looked out the window, and I saw the blue mailbox, but it was just a spiffy trash bin. And it really brought home to me, you know, the immigrants, the suffering, the humiliation of being a stranger in a strange land, not knowing the language, not knowing the customs, and you're there just to work and to be able to feed your children.
You know, what's interesting and clear is, you know, that since the election of Pope Francis, there's been more emphasis coming out of Rome on issues having to do with the poor and the immigrant and so on, which tends to cut against bishops' preferences for the Republicans, since they don't tend to emphasize those issues, but more the culture war issues, including abortion and same-sex marriage and so on. And I'd say that some of the enthusiasm with which bishops entered into those issues has been dampened, and particularly now that you know, same-sex marriage is rapidly becoming the law of the entire land. You know, they sort of seem to have somewhat pulled in their horns on that one.
When I was on the bus, people were cheering and clapping, and there was music and signs and gifts. You would think we were rock stars getting off the bus.
That's so great. How great did that feel?
Well, it was humbling. It was humbling because we just felt like we're these old ladies getting off the bus. You know, most of us are up there in age, and yet the credibility that people have in us is really heartwarming.
Yeah, that's kind of a sad fact, isn't it? That your numbers are dwindling. What's to become of this kind of work if young
the nuns
women
aren't there?
Yeah.
God will lift up other people like yourself and many others who will also be, you know, the voice of the powerless and the voiceless, will be attentive to what God is asking of them in their lives. I mean, I see the witness of so many folks who are not, you know, religious women or priests or ministers who are doing incredible things. So I think it's a shift. I think there'll always be some nuns, but I think that we're making room for everybody, and so it's up to all of us. All of us count. All of us are.
Maybe it's
witnesses.
A moment for the laity to step up.
Well, that was the message of Vatican Council, too. It was ushering in the age of the laity, and that's 50 years ago. And we still have to appropriate the great gift of that council and the documents that were written and the direction that was seen during those years and proclaimed, and we need to own it more. And so we're still going forward. So this age of the laity is becoming a reality.
Finally, we wrapped the year up by delving into the subject of hyper-incarceration, society's zeal to lock up nonviolent offenders. Our guides were Cindy Cloney, who spent 3 years in prison for bank robbery, and attorney Brian Moran, author of The Justice Imperative. And then we closed out the year by taking up Pope Francis's peacemaking overtures. First, his diplomatic involvement in the standoff between the U.S. and Cuba, and then what can only have been his hand in the kinder, gentler tone of a Vatican report on American nuns.
I wouldn't have gotten as far so quickly if it wasn't for him.
What can you think of any of the wise things he told you that kind of took?
Oh, God, there was...
You say he had a different perspective on the faith.
He did. You know, he'd call us God's girl and, you know, like basically saying, you know, would be, though you know you committed this crime, you know what I mean? God still loves you. He's forgiven you, so you need to forgive you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because
if God can do it.
Right? Who are you not to, really? Yeah. So, I mean, it was little isms like that. I wish I could remember them. You know, they were so profound that they just kind of became a part of me, you know, and I lived like that. He used to give us the Walmart blessing. It was the funniest thing. You know, we'd go to church every week, and if somebody was leaving, he would give a shout out from the pulpit and be like, okay, we got to give so-and-so, they're leaving, let's give them the Walmart blessing. Hope to see you in Walmart, not back here, you know what I mean? And it was the greatest thing because, I mean, we laughed at church. I don't ever remember laughing at church my whole life. You know, we used to call the church on the west side Our Lady of the Loading Dock because that's where it was, on the loading dock. Folding chairs set up. Yeah. Our Lady of the Loading Dock.
Wow.
The other side, we had a chapel. We had a nice chapel, actually. I actually sang in the choir, as scary as that sounds.
Why would that be scary?
Oh, because you never heard me sing.
Wow.
So, but, yeah. But he was just, God, I wish I had some great words of wisdom I could give you. I wish he was here. Yeah. But, yeah, no, it was just the fact that I think he gave me that sense of, like, you know, I'm not judging you.
Yeah.
Basically what he was saying. You know, I'm like, I'm not here to judge you. You know, and I was able to, you know, get that impression from him right off the bat. Because
he sees you as a person.
He did. He did. And he's, I mean, you got to figure, too, he's seeing everybody. Like, and we're all in different levels of, you know, of...
your journeys.
Yes, most definitely. And he's seen it all. And he's very non-judgmental and just very... You could feel the love from him. Not, you know, in just a positive, you know, caring way. You know, and then there's not, you know, you gotta figure there's not a lot of whole heck of a lot of that going around in a jail. You know what I mean?
Right. I'm aware that it's annoying to certain Republicans, not to put too fine a point on it, that the Pope is involved like this. Marco Rubio apparently is breaking out in a rash over the Cuba thing.
Well, I do think that certainly in the United States, there has been a Pope Francis backlash building.
Oh.
And that this in some ways adds to it. I know certain conservative Catholics, or a number of conservative Catholics, are concerned about the direction of the papacy, particularly after Pope Francis's comments about gays and lesbians, for example.
Right. Who am I to judge?
Yes, and I think this will intensify their concern in the sense that the Vatican, which was often seen to be a bulwark against communism, is now somehow changing its tune or becoming a little more flexible in ways that some conservative Catholics would find disconcerting.
Somehow that makes me happy.
Yeah.
Am I a bad person?
Well, I don't know. I think this is tough to talk about. I mean, I think I do share some of your feelings, but I also tell myself that it's important for us as a church to be a global community and to be a community that does tolerate diverse opinions about political issues. And I think having felt for a long time, for the last 20, 30 years, that progressive views in Catholicism have been sidelined, I wouldn't necessarily want to do the same thing to my conservative Catholic friends, even though I might disagree with them very gently or sometimes very strongly on certain kinds of issues.
Wow, you have conservative Catholic friends.
I do.
You're an enlightened being.
I think there have been a lot of abuses. I mean, I've had sisters call or write me to tell me things like they have they have collected all of their Liturgy of the Hour, the Hours books, the yeah. public prayer of the church, collected those and replaced them with a version that has removed all of the male pronouns yes. referring to God.
But and I guess it would be too much to expect the church to say, well, let a thousand flowers bloom.
Well, the thing is, the public prayer of the church is not an individual thing that, right. that to be taken to rewrite.
And that'll do it for our Year in Review show. Again, thank you for listening. I invite you to offer any suggestions or ideas for the show by contacting me through the ReasonablyCatholic.com blog. Meanwhile, I wish you a happy continuing Christmas season and all the best in 2015. I'm Maria Johnson. See you next week.